Welcome back to the Our Voices podcast. I'm Freddie Stewart. In this episode, myself and Aaron White speak to Shahid Buttar, a progressive candidate running to represent California's 12th congressional district in the upcoming November election. Shahid is challenging House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the most powerful Democrat in Washington, D.C. In March, Buttar came second in California's non-blanket primary process, making his campaign the first challenge Pelosi has faced from the left in over 30 years. Buttar is running on a platform that advocates for a Green New Deal, Medicare for All, and overhauling the military-industrial complex. Last week, we caught up with him to discuss how the pandemic has affected his insurgent campaign and explore why he believes a change of leadership is required to combat America's socio-economic crises. So here's our interview with Shahid Buttar. So I wondered if you could start with telling us a little bit about yourself and about the congressional race that you're running in.
Thank you for that. I'm an immigrant to the United States. I was born in the UK, actually to a family in the South Asian diaspora. And I'm running for Congress in San Francisco to replace Nancy Pelosi. She is the leader of the Democratic Party, a committed moderate to center-right conservative, certainly by international standards. And when I look at our entirely dysfunctional national government in Washington, I see, unfortunately, the elected representative of our city's most progressive city in Washington, Nancy Pelosi, actively enabling conservative interests, including a criminal president. And at the end of the day, particularly as an immigrant, I take very seriously and I'm very concerned about a number of values that I think many Americans take for granted. And one of them for me is democracy. And I see, unfortunately, the speaker in a number of different ways, and I'm happy to get into those issues, undermining our democracy. And I'm running to vindicate it and defend it at a time when it's in crisis.
Right. And insurgent grassroots campaigns, especially those challenging central establishment figures, often rely on bringing in new voters, often young voters. How has this current pandemic kind of affected your campaign strategy, and what are your plans to overcome that?
Yeah, thank you for raising that. The challenge for us is particularly that we can't knock on doors. You know, we just took second place, which is one of the two winning positions in our jungle primary a month ago, which puts me in the position to be the first challenger from within the Democratic Party that Nancy Pelosi will have ever faced in a November election over the course of her 30-year career, which I aim very much to end. Now, given our results in the primary, we have to double our support twice in the city. We, in the primary phase, we were supported by 14,000 Americans. We won 33,000 votes from San Franciscans. We have 6 months to double that twice. And we put in place a field plan to do it and sort of estimated how many volunteer shifts we'd need to get there. And then a pandemic hit, which, you know, to your question, really requires a very sharp pivot in a lot of different ways. So the first way that we responded to the pandemic was to suspend voter outreach entirely and pivot to mutual aid. You know, in the particularly, I think the first weeks, no less now, but particularly in those first weeks, people were just very challenged in a lot of different ways. You know, how to get food? What is the future going to look like? How am I going to pay my rent? And I don't think people were really as interested in politics. And frankly, you know, for us, it was more about just how do we show up and be helpful at the moment? We, as a campaign, aren't really set up to do service delivery, though I did have an opportunity. I'm still healthy. And so I had a few chances to volunteer with different community groups that were working around food security or health security for frontline workers serving unhoused populations especially. But the campaign operation really just focused on calling first our volunteers and then voters to make sure people knew where they can get a free meal and how they can qualify for the state program to defer rent payments, for instance. So that was our first pivot. While we were doing that, we were putting in place the infrastructure, the digital tools to enable distributed phone banking. And so this gets to the heart of your question. Since we can't knock on doors, we have to flood the phones. And that's what we're doing. We, over the course of the last month, we put in place those tools to provide an experience not very much unlike the Bernie dialer, which many volunteers around the country participated in to help fuel Bernie's campaign. When I look at his campaign and people plugging in on the phones, we often only had a few weeks to cover entire states. We still have over 6 months and just a single city. So this is absolutely within reach. We're glad to be joined by hundreds of callers on the phones already. We're going to grow that to thousands. And with that kind of support from around the country, I frankly don't think that Nancy Pelosi has a chance this November, and I'm looking forward to proving that.
As you say, obviously, your campaign is finding new ways of organizing to take on the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who has recently herself come in for criticism, particularly with the now infamous ice cream shot that was done on late night television. But I wondered if you could speak a little bit more to how Nancy Pelosi herself sort of typifies an ideological shift that's taken place within the Democratic Party over the last 40 years.
Absolutely. And I so appreciate you raising that. But that is ultimately the central rationale for my campaign. I've seen Nancy Pelosi enter Congress as a progressive, and over time, particularly as she has attained a leadership position within the Democratic Party, abandon San Francisco's interests in order to privilege her perceived interests of the rest of the party. And for her, what that has particularly meant is defending the most right-wing, most conservative Democrats, even against challenges from more progressive Democrats, more aligned even with the speaker's stated values. And I want to put wheels on that car. There were two races in particular this year, aside from ours challenging her, where the speaker, frankly, betrayed even core ideals of feminism. And I'm thinking here of reproductive liberty and choice. Nancy Pelosi supported anti-choice reproductive authoritarian Democratic incumbents in both Illinois and Texas, Dan Lipinski and Henry Cuellar, against challengers from young, progressive women of color who would have offered the party more sincere representation, more feminist representation. And in the face of those challenges, Nancy Pelosi stood, as she always has, on the side of the past. And that's the issue here. As the elected leader of the Democrats in the House, Nancy Pelosi could, on the one hand, support the needs of the future and the bold paradigm that is supported by the majority of Americans, bipartisan majorities support universal healthcare in the United States. But our elected Democratic Speaker of the House does not. And not only does she not support universal healthcare, but she actively stands in the way. And I want to contrast, you know, one set of issues, or two sets of issues when contrasted, to me, reveal in more stark relief the pattern of the speaker's representation than any other. And that is the calamitous decline, the collapse, you might say, in federal spending on affordable housing during her tenure, which should not surprise us. She is a wealthy landlord, so it's no surprise that she would not be looking out for renters' interests. But at the same time that the federal government has abandoned spending on affordable housing, creating a preventable housing crisis around the United States, particularly here in San Francisco. But at the same time, our military spending, with Speaker Pelosi's support, continued to climb through the roof. And just to be explicit about this, the money that we squandered on fraudulent weapons that can't respond to our nation's national security needs vastly, vastly eclipsed whatever savings we gained from abandoning renters. And to see renters abandoned to a predatory market while military contracts for fraudulent weapons that we don't need and that can't meet our security needs are privileged, I see in that contrast the speaker's priorities revealed. She is ultimately an agent of Wall Street and an agent of the Beltway. And what San Francisco should deserve, what we deserve, is an elected voice in Washington fighting for our city's values. And that's what I've been over the last 20 years. You know, I've fought Bush's wars, I fought Obama's deportations and drone strikes, I fought Trump's corruption. And across all three of those administrations, I had to also unfortunately challenge Nancy Pelosi's complicity. And I'm tired of doing that. As a constituent, I'm looking forward to doing that as her replacement.
Great. And building upon how you mentioned the housing crisis, I was wondering if you can describe what you propose you think should be done to guarantee affordable housing to all Americans in the U.S. And yes, within the context of the current pandemic, are you in favor of rent and mortgage moratoriums?
Yeah, let's take it in reverse order. So yes, absolutely. Rent and mortgage freezes and forgiveness. A lot of people think of the moratorium as a delay in payments that then continue to accrue and become due in balloon payments at the end. Unfortunately, a lot of San Franciscans and Californians generally are facing that future now, where our local and state leadership has recognized intelligently that with the economy effectively shut down, working class Americans can't work. They can't get to their jobs unless they've been deemed essential. If people can't work, it is not only unfair to expect them to produce monthly payments for their housing, but it creates a social risk because so many people can't work right now. The threat of mass evictions, and let's be clear about this, especially during a pandemic, creates not just the moral travesty and of homelessness that, frankly, you know, rests on all of our shoulders, but specifically a vital public health contagion vector. And, you know, here in San Francisco, I've rarely been as grateful to be a San Franciscan as I have over the last month, particularly because our local and state leadership was quite prescient in responding to the needs presented by the pandemic, not only instituting the delay in payments, though I do favor a freeze as well, but they also issued very early shelter in place orders. What they did not do was make any pretense of serving our unhoused population, which was placed at risk unnecessarily, which was then housed in congregate settings, which expanded the risks, and which finally the city in San Francisco is making moves to put people in hotel rooms, which are conveniently empty because there's effectively no travel at the moment. So that's a no-brainer policy. It serves public health, it serves the hotels, it serves the unhoused communities, serves the rest of us by diminishing contagion vectors, but it took a long time, even for our progressive leaders here, to figure that out. And they still have yet to support the freeze and forgiveness on the forgiveness beyond the freeze on payments. To your first part of your question about housing generally and what I want to do to make sure that housing becomes affordable again, and ideally better than just affordable, the vision I have for housing ultimately is one shared by, for instance, Ilhan Omar and Bernie Sanders. And in their Green New Deal for Public Housing, what they envision first is a substantial investment in retrofitting existing federally owned housing stock. And there is a lot of it. Not nearly enough. The Faircloth Amendment prohibited the federal government from buying housing under its own auspices, which really created a neoliberal alternative in Section 8 that we've been limited to over the last generation. But I also want to repeal the Faircloth Amendment to ensure that the federal government can purchase housing again. And I'd like to develop a model of social housing that has housing owned by the government, but accountable to the residents and communities. That's a combination that we haven't actually had in the United States before. When we've had federally owned housing projects, they were notoriously unaccountable to residents, and that created any number of predictable problems. Responsiveness with public ownership, I think, is the key. On the way to getting to that vision, there are some discrete things that we can do in the meantime, and these are realizable pieces of the platform that I'm looking forward to moving in the next Congress. The first is federalizing an initiative, an innovation, you might say, that began here in San Francisco. San Francisco and New York City are the only two cities in the country, as far as I know, where local leadership has approved civil representation as a matter of right for people facing evictions. Let me explain what that means. In the United States, by decree of the Supreme Court many years ago, anyone facing criminal prosecution who can't afford a lawyer gets a public defender. That is a lawyer paid for at public expense. What this law in San Francisco and New York does is expand that class of beneficiaries, the people who are entitled to a publicly funded lawyer, beyond people facing criminal prosecution to include people facing eviction. And the rationale is that if you might be homeless, you should have representation. No one should be pushed into the street simply because they didn't have a voice representing them in a process vis-a-vis a landlord. And that's law here in San Francisco. It could be law across the country. And I think the key there is a granting program to make available to states the resources to hire lawyers to serve as tenants' representatives to people facing eviction. That's an easy step forward that will make a huge difference in the lives of the people at the margin. This is kind of a no-brainer here, but that's just restoring the budget for the investment in the neoliberal existing housing subsidy program. Those are the community development block grants through HUD, the Agency for Housing and Urban Development. This was the budget that a few minutes ago I was describing having collapsed over the last two generations. And it is precisely what we need to start by reinvesting in. So reinvesting in block grants to states to provide incentives to property developers to include affordable units when they're developing new properties, that's one piece. Extending the right to civil representation to people facing eviction across the country, that's a second piece. A third piece is this Green New Deal for public housing, retrofitting existing public housing stock to make it more attractive and sustainable. And then finally, getting to a new era of social housing, where we have the federal government making substantial investments in direct ownership of large properties or small properties, any number of different kinds of properties with flexible management structures that are accountable to the communities that those properties are in.
Thank you. Thank you for that. That was really interesting. I'd like to ask you about another aspect of the current crisis that I'm finding particularly fascinating at the moment and scary at the moment, which is the intensification of surveillance capitalism, what Shoshana Zuboff would call surveillance capitalism. Yeah. And obviously, as a San Franciscan, someone running in San Francisco, you are closely aligned to and will have felt the influence of Silicon Valley. So I wondered how you see the solutionism coming into play, where Google and Facebook are sort of offering up examples and everyone is clamoring for big tech to provide the solutions to the current crisis, but also what you would tangibly look to achieve in Congress to counter, if you think it's a negative, the role of these surveillance capitalists in our society.
Thank you so much. You're asking a question that's very near to my heart. In fact, this to some extent is the discrete reason I'm running for Congress. It was 2018 in the spring. I was working at the time at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. It's the world's most prolific digital civil liberties organization. And one of our logins running struggles is challenging government surveillance and the threat that it presents not only to privacy, but also to dissent and through it, democracy. And I watched Speaker Pelosi undermine a proposed surveillance reform on which me and my colleagues were working. And that was the discrete point when I started thinking about running, was watching for the, you know, maybe half dozenth time Pelosi standing on the side of authoritarianism, promoting surveillance capitalism, undermining government transparency, undermining constitutional rights, standing, as she always does, on behalf of military industrial interests in this case, rather than we the people of the United States, who she's sworn an oath to represent in Congress. And in the context of the pandemic, I am certainly alarmed. You know, you raise a reference to the Google and Apple project around contact tracing with their phones. And I want to make a sharp distinction here between companies whose business models inhere in selling information, and that's advertising-driven companies, particularly Facebook, Google come to mind, versus companies that make their business model inherent in selling products, and particularly Apple comes to mind there. And I want to just contrast their competing positions as it relates to privacy and data protection. One of the very first things I did when I got to EFF, I started in the fall of 2015, and in the spring of 2016, I had the opportunity to defend Apple publicly because the company was defending its users in the face of an FBI attempt to force Apple to hack its own users. And this was an incredibly important issue. And you never saw Google or Facebook take an analogous position, probably because their business models are ultimately in tension with the privacy interests of their consumers. Apple, because it doesn't sell information, it sells devices and software, but particularly not information about its users to commercial advertising entities, it was able to make a different choice. And so I offer that just to help increase the granularity when we talk about big tech of what we're talking about, because it's not just big tech, it's big advertising-driven corporate surveillance entities. Corporate surveillance is the precursor to online advertising. And that part of the business model is the problem. And I just want to explain that. It's not big tech generally. It is online advertising requiring corporate surveillance of users. That's the ultimate issue here. And I certainly am concerned about it. When we think about contact tracing by Google or Apple, I want to make a couple points here. First, the purpose of that program is very different than the kinds of programs that Edward Snowden revealed, where the government was, for instance, hacking companies. The program Bull Run comes to mind, one of the several that he revealed. And it was essentially the NSA, National Security Agencies, or no such agencies, practice of hacking big companies to take data about users, whatever the companies refuse to give through a legal process, which is just to say, whatever a company gets, the government can get too. And the reason I raise that is because even though this program has different goals in mind, you know, it's not national security, it's public health, it's still, however, the same recommendations that we've made in the national security context should apply here, which is to say, these programs should be transparent. People should have a right to opt in. There should be limits on the use of this information. There should be limits on how long it is retained. There should be limits on who it is shared with and under what circumstances. All these kinds of parameters are the sort that do not exist in the national security context. There are no limits on use or retention or dissemination, right? It's just open season. And so whether it's in the national security context, whether it's in the public health context, any data collection, period, must respect the user's right to opt in. So people should be affirmatively allowed to consent to participate, not forced. they must also be subject to transparency, and not just in the aggregate, but people should answer questions about particular outcomes that are driven by algorithms to make sure that we don't have decision-making by avarice. I can come back to this in a minute if it's interesting. One of the videos I did with a journalist recently was censored by an online platform, and I'd love to talk about that if it fits. Hopefully that gets at it. Maybe one last thing I'd say here is that with respect to regulating companies, tech companies, once I'm in Congress, my goal there particularly relates to reviving and resuscitating antitrust law. My very first object of study when I trained at Stanford Law School 20 years ago was antitrust law. I saw it as the solution to protecting any number of things, particularly the rise of corporate America. I worked on Wall Street in the 90s. And so I saw the precursors to the 2008 financial crisis. And I've long recognized that corporate America needs to be reined in. Antitrust law is a big part of that. Hasn't been effectively used in 20 years. There's a lot more I could say, but I'll turn it back to you.
Yeah, just another question I'd like to kind of expand on is the military-industrial complex. I know you mentioned it briefly. Both Democrats and Republicans in the United States have been complicit, especially figures such as Nancy Pelosi and now the presumptive Democratic nominee, Joe Biden, voting for the Iraq War and the Patriot Act, et cetera. Yeah. I'm wondering if you can explain what a progressive foreign policy would look like for you, and what are some policy proposals that you would like to push while in Congress?
Absolutely. This is another area that for me is very important. As an immigrant to this country, I feel very much that I'm in a position to represent not just the voices of San Franciscans, but ultimately a global community that has long been impacted in very unfortunate ways by an abusive, militaristic, resource-grabby, belligerent, unilateral U.S. foreign policy. And I'm happy to share what a progressive alternative looks like. To get there, let me just share a little bit about my concerns and how I've had a chance to express them. There's an organization called Project Censored, which publishes an annual volume of stories that are underreported in the US media. The 2017 volume includes a chapter that I wrote titled Ike's Dystopian Dream. And it's a reference to a vision shared by President Dwight Eisenhower. It's the speech where the term the military-industrial complex was coined. And the context of the speech is incredibly important. I often invite people to listen to it again. It's on YouTube. And Ike, in the style of his day, is something of a dry orator. But the words, if you just read the transcript, the power of it comes across even more chillingly than when he speaks it. But he says in the speech very clearly that he felt compelled, and he probably was compelled, to create an industrial arms industry to fight the Nazis. And he laments the necessity of that maneuver in this speech. And he goes on to say, it, this arms industry, and the profit motive inherent in security, whether we're talking about the military or whether we're talking about policing, and I want to come back to that in just a minute, he says that that combination, industry plus the profit motive and security, will threaten democracy in America. It will threaten our rights and our liberties. He says it will transform the spiritual character of the United States and every town in it. It's an incredibly visionary speech. And one of the things about it that alarms me most is just how completely America forgot it. I mean, this was broadcast on national TV at the birth of the medium. There was probably no speech more widely seen on the planet in its era. It wasn't that long ago. It was two generations, right? We're talking within a lifetime, 65 years ago. And in the years since, its architect warned us to stay knowledgeable and alert about the abuses of our military-industrial complex. Here is just a short rundown of some of the things that we have done. Serial interventions in dozens of countries around the world to steal resources that were under their soil, particularly fossil fuels. I just want to say that to tag how this has impacted climate justice, not just the human rights in the countries that we have, you know, supported by giving democracy at the barrel of a gun. In addition to those wars for profit, we've also seen any number of human rights abuses. And I want to talk about one set of them in particular, and that is torture by the CIA. The CIA is a central figure in the serial abuses of our military-industrial complex, and it hides behind executive secrecy any number of things, including international human rights abuses. We have tortured to the point of rape and murder, not just hundreds of detainees in the context of the war on terror, but I want to rewind the clock back to Latin America in the 80s and the 90s. Tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people have been killed, often in paramilitary execution style, by death squads trained by the US military. And this is a pattern in which we have long been complicit. A progressive foreign policy puts human rights before corporate resource extraction. A progressive foreign policy is knowledgeable and alert, as we were all invited to be by the architect of our arms industry, about its potential abuses, not just of human rights, but also our budget. Len, let's talk about the budgetary impact of the military-industrial complex. There's a particular fighter plane platform, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. This fighter platform will cost over $2 trillion over the life cycle of the program. It has been beset by problems with respect to delivering products on time in conformity with the spec for years. The plane literally could not be flown because it was pieced together with specs from different service branches. It didn't operate. They had to re-engineer the plane because they were literally building it while they were designing it, which is, for anyone who's been involved in any design process of any kind, is an obvious recipe for cost overruns. And I would just ask, what is the point of spending $2 trillion on a fighter plane that can't fight a virus, that can't keep the post office open, and it can't fight climate change? Those are our three greatest national security imperatives at the moment, is a pandemic, climate chaos, and preserving the integrity of our elections and ensuring that our republic continues beyond November. A fighter plane doesn't give you any of those things. So when they tell us we don't have money for Medicare for All during a time of pandemic, when there is an actual national security threat that we are grappling with, the policy that would most directly address it is universal health care. That's a national security policy I can get behind. That's a progressive, maybe not foreign policy, but at least national security policy. You know, another dimension here that I just want to touch on is the domestic facing side of that military industrial complex, and that's policing and the surveillance capitalism that you asked about before, particularly immigration enforcement. After having abused people around the world in the service of filling the pockets of weapons contractors, particularly, our military industrial complex turned its sights on the American people. Our chickens have come home to roost, particularly in the form of paramilitary police around the United States. And all of those examples, CIA human rights abuses, wars for profit, surveillance capitalism, paramilitary policing, mass incarceration, all of these are examples of our civilization's ignorance, having forgotten the warning that we were given on national television. I didn't hear it at the time, I wasn't alive yet, but as a student of history, I understand the incredible importance of that speech and the things that he warned us about that have happened all in very sharp relief in the time since. But you can't find a Democrat to recognize that, because as you described, there's never been a war that Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi haven't voted for. You know, they are cheerleaders of this sordid attack on our rights. And as a constituent, as a constitutional lawyer, as now a candidate for Congress, having already sworn an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, I'm very eager to do the job that Nancy Pelosi has refused, for whatever reason, to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you trying to bring some perspective to that history of U.S. interventionism. And I would point anyone listening to this in the future to our last podcast we did for Open Democracy, which included that speech from Dwight D. Eisenhower. Nice. But to bring us back to the current moment for a second, I was wondering whether I could get your perspective on, obviously what you're trying to do is win your race, clearly, but you're also looking to push the narrative with more progressive ideals. And I wondered how confident you are that Biden, as the Democratic nominee, can be persuaded by the clear popularity of campaigns like yours, but also obviously Bernie Sanders and other progressives around the country.
That Biden's campaign can be persuaded by us to do what?
I mean, just to push his platform to the left. Obviously, right. We've seen even in the last 4 years that, you know, on things like climate change, he's dramatically shifted his political stance.
Right. And I appreciate you raising this opportunity for Biden to better show up and to respect interests that he hasn't been as solicitous of in the past. I can't prognosticate as to his likelihood to meet us halfway. But I will say very much that if Democrats want to win the next election, they're going to need the young people who very vastly support the progressive vision that Joe Biden has not supported in his time in Congress. And as an architect of mass incarceration, as a cheerleader for wars, as the quarterback that put Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court, and Joe Biden has unfortunately disappointed me more or less at every turn in his past. I can't remember a set of issues where he has actually impressed me. And he's had plenty of chances to do it. I do hope that he takes that opportunity to meet us halfway, because if he doesn't, for instance, support universal health care, if he doesn't support climate justice it's entirely predictable to me that he will lose the election. And I, you know, we can't have another 4 years of Trump. To be fair, if Biden is the president, without making those pivots, I don't think he'll be much better. And whether it's a President Trump or whether it's a President Biden, I'm anticipating that when I go to Congress after replacing Nancy Pelosi, I will be fighting whoever the president is from the left. And I would much rather have the opportunity to support a president with a meaningful commitment to the American people, which neither of them have seemed to exhibit. To the extent that's not available as an opportunity, I will be very happy to do the best I can to stave off the worst possible outcomes of the future. And I think you're right, certainly, to lay out the question. The opportunity before Biden is to either remain committed to his corporate principles and putting corporate interests before communities, in which case he will lose the election, or he can at least start to adopt some of these positions he has refused to adopt in the past, positions favored by the majority of Americans, starting with universal health care, and I think including a more progressive approach to the foreign policy that he has engineered, the abusive, predatory, extractive foreign policy that he has been so effective in engineering over the last generation. If he takes that opportunity to adopt new positions, to keep his ear to the ground and listen to the future, I think there's a real opportunity here. If he doesn't, I fear that future very much.
Great. And just one final question here. So if you do take down Nancy Pelosi and Democrats remain in majority, that'll obviously leave a spot open for a new speaker. Are there any ideas of people that you would like to see take the, yes, take the reins?
Absolutely. Here in the Bay Area, the leader of our congressional delegation is Barbara Lee. She is a stalwart champion of civil rights. She voted against the war in Iraq. She voted against the Patriot Act. She has always stood on the side of the American people. And as there are a lot of voices in Congress increasingly that are willing to do that. I think about the Progressive Caucus. It is the largest caucus in the Democratic Party. And there's lots of voices in it I'm inspired by, certainly everyone in the squad. Also Representatives Ro Khanna in San Jose, Pramila Jayapal in Seattle. These are a lot of inspiring, insightful, experienced voices in the House. Barbara Lee is probably the longest serving among the ones who I would describe as having long been willing to challenge the Washington establishment. And so, you know, when people, I sometimes hear from folks who don't pay a lot of attention to politics, oh, what'll San Francisco do when we don't have the speaker anymore? And, you know, the first issue there is the speaker's never done anything for San Francisco. So San Francisco derives no benefit from her being the speaker. Secondly, the Bay Area can retain a leadership position here. And if Barbara Lee were the speaker, the Bay Area would actually have sincere representation instead of simply theatrical representation that is co-opting our region's sensibility. Barbara Lee is a much more sincere representative of the Bay Area's political convictions than Nancy Pelosi has been. And so I'm very eager to get Barbara Lee the gavel after replacing Nancy Pelosi in the 12th congressional district seat.
Great. Well, Shahid Bitar, thank you so much for joining us here. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. I would just invite your listeners to check us out online at shahidforchange.us or on any of the major social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitch, at Shahid for Change.
Great. Thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking out the time.
Same to you. Thanks for the interview. Keep up the great work.
Thank you for listening to this Our Voices podcast from Open Democracy. If you enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen, why not head to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a review? Open Democracy is an independent global media platform that is only possible because of your kind donations. To find out more or to make a donation, head to opendemocracy.net.